Good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Atlantic Tales, when we'll visit Killoo Church near Clare Castle and step back 1,000 years to see how life looked in medieval Ireland. From early pagan worship to Viking invaders and the arrival of the Normans, the site of a church at Killoo near Clare Castle in County Clare has given us a direct link with the past, and the more research is undertaken, the more we learn about the community that formed around this ancient site. The fascinating story of Killoo Church begins long before the building we see today ever existed, maybe as far back as 500 AD. While there may be little written evidence about the church's history, anecdotal references and folklore tell us there was something important about it. In the summer of 2022, a committee was established to address the slow degradation of the church building and surrounding walls. Gerard Lynch is a founding member of Killoo Church Restoration Project, CLG.
The background to Killoo Church is interesting. Dominic Leeson, the historian, where it said of the Killoo Church that it was the oldest standing church in the Diocese of Killaloe. And I think what Dermot Leeson would have meant by that was it was the best example of a church of its period that we'll say is in recognisable, is in good standing form. So the church as we see today goes back to about the year 1000. We don't have an exact date on that, but we can be pretty certain it's mentioned in the records when Clare Abbey was established in 1195, Killoo Church was part of the property that was pulled into the Clare Abbey establishment. During the work here for the conservation, we had to carry out the evaluation of the site under John Deaton, and the work there identified, using LIDAR technology, that this site goes back to pagan times, to the 5th, 6th century at least, because there are two mounds or boundaries running around the graveyard, one within and one outside, which indicate that date. And subsequently, from that identification, excavation has been carried out to establish that those mounds are there. So this is going back to a pagan site. It was practiced when Christian churches were established here, what, in the 5th, 6th century, that they used the extending pagan sites as a place to bring in their religious, their new religious establishment. This was an island, Killoo was an island. It was one of many islands on the estuary, so we have the barony of the islands. And it was an island up to around 1790, I think it was, when the river Fergus was banked by the O'Briens. And of course that totally changed the nature of the territory here. The church itself goes back to around the year 1000 and quite probably was succeeding maybe a timber structure that would have been here prior to that. Its proximity to the river is crucial. And of course, as in all of these things, location is very important. The location of Killoo is significant. It's on the river. It's a crossing point from east to west. We are here on the east side of the river. So this was McNamara territory going across into O'Brien territory. Clare Ata Cora, the old name for Clare Castle, was the crossing point, Clare being a board, a crossing point, which subsequently gave its name to the county. So its location is significant on the river. And I presume that is the way early settlers would have settled here. They'd have come up the river, they'd have seen raised ground, and they put some sort of an establishment there. Dick Cronin would say that the church was a community centre. So we can imagine huts or little dwellings around the place, timber huts or whatever. These would have been used not just for the religious practice, which it would have been used for, but the early church settlement here would have also been the community centre. what we have done here, I think, which is important, is that in many, many ways, this was a lost part of our history. Not lost, but forgotten. And we're in establishing the importance of a place like Killoo, we are reawakening a past that's forgotten. And the lesson that we can learn here is, this is the place where paganism transfers to Christianity, where the Anglo-Norman settlements overtake the old Celtic settlements. And then it also has the echoes of colonialism, because Clarecastle itself was the last standing place of the Battle of Limerick in 1691. It simply was too small to defend. That's why it didn't fall into the picture. Williamite troops would have camped quite near here in the 1640s. At that stage, when the Williamite troops would have camped in Clarecastle, Killoo Church at that stage was no longer in practice. It was gone. But I would say that the establishment of Clare Abbey in 1195 would have had a significant impact on a place like Killoo Church, because here was, we talk about going into Europe, 1195 was our accession to Europe. The Italian church came and was established here, and that was a significant event on the culture and nature of society around here.
Would you have been aware growing up of the existence of Killoo, and would you have come over here often?
Well, Killoo had a particular, I suppose that's why when we started out here I had a particular interest in Killoo. The Lynches, my family would have been buried here for over 300 years. The graves here behind you would have been the first graves outside the ground, the four graves on the floor. They would be Lynch graves. The Lynches came here in 1690 after the Battle of Aucrim, the Williamite Wars. They were pushed out of Galway, as Catholic families were. The Lynches settled here because they had a particular relationship with the O'Briens. They were connected through marriage. They were also connected through being legal advisors, whatever, to the O'Briens. The Lynches were a very well-established trading family in Galway. 1690, they come out of there, as all Catholic families did, and my branch of the family finished up here in Killoo. In 1848, this tomb here was built by Thomas Lynch. And during the course of the conservation work here, the cross on the tomb is an order cross, and it is links back to the Crusaders. Now, I did not know that until John Deaton made reference to why was the cross of that nature on it. And of course, in St. Nicholas's Church in Galway, in front of the Lynch window is the Crusaders' tomb. So the guy who built this place here in 1848, he obviously was aware of a family history, in some way linking back to that. But that story is only of importance in the broader context of the impact of colonialism and British rule in Ireland after 1690. The established families, the trading of places like Galway City was destroyed, with huge implications for the Irish economy. The Irish economy effectively, as we all know, up to the 1960s, from 1700 to 1960, we became a third world country. So all of that trade, all of that commerce, all of that economic sophistication disappeared over those 250 years at an enormous cost to the well-being of people.
A lot of history here, a lot of family history here. At what point did you become really interested in the story of Killoo? As you say, it was hidden away, not completely lost, but could have been lost had your group not taken up the mantle.
I would have to give a huge credit to Michael Slattery. Michael and myself have friendship going back 40 years, and Michael said to me, well, are we going to do anything about Killoo? And about 7 or 8 years ago, I'm not sure exactly when, we said, we'll take this seriously. We put together a group of very good people. And in the course of that evaluation, funded by Community Monument Fund, in the course of that evaluation, the importance of Killoo became clearer in my mind. I always knew it as a very old church. I mentioned Dermot Leeson, the historian, talking about it as a medieval church, the oldest standing church in the diocese. But of course, It was only during the course of work that we realized that it goes back maybe to the 5th century or earlier, the site itself. So the significance of the place grew during the course of our work here. It's not just about the local area. It is about how civilization, as we know it, written civilization, the 4th, 5th century, how that was established, how we lived 1,500 years ago. Kalu tells that story. And that story is a story that's replicated all over the country. It's very important that we know that story, that we connect to it, that it has a meaning to us, because certainly here it has been forgotten, and as it has been in an awful lot of the country. We're very fortunate that we have a building here that's standing for 1,000 years, that is now conserved thanks to national funding from Community Monument Fund, and that it is there to tell that story going into the future. So that we have a deep sense of the impact of these changes on people. Not that we're anything different from anyone else. The story here is the story for everyone in the country, how we transfer from paganism, Christianity, the impact of paganism on Christian practice. That's a very important story. The impact of the Norman invasion on the Celtic population, the impact of colonialism and now a post-colonial society, how we relate all things together to tell our story of who we are and what we are.
The original idea to assess what could be done to conserve Kalu Church was born from a conversation between Gerard Lynch and Michael Slattery after a mass held at the site. Michael is chair of Kalu Church Restoration Project, CLG.
Gerard Lynch and I were over there near the door, and we were looking at this ruin, which was very close to collapse. And one said to the other, why don't we do something about this? We had a few jokes, of course, that said that's not possible, etc. But the seed was sown. COVID intervened. We could do nothing about it for 2 years. And then after COVID, the seed having been sown, we decided that we would do something now. So we formed a committee, Gerard and I, and we asked various people to join us. Some said no, but in the main, we got a very good group. And I suppose the essence of the success of this place is the quality of the people. The people that we got were the two Barrys. Their people are buried here. And with them, we got Heber McMahon, an outstanding community activist. Gerard, of course, was there. And then we went to Liam Ash, wonderful historian and a great love of this place. So we formed the company, we looked at various ways of getting money, and we suddenly discovered that the Clare County Council would have a role to play in it. We approached the council, we spoke to some very nice people there, Conchella Maguire was there, and they said that fundamentally we'll have to do this work on our own. They haven't the money, but they could lead us towards it. So we discovered very quickly that there were three vital requirements. One, we had to deal with the Heritage Council. Secondly, we had to deal with the Clare County Council. And the most important one of all, deal with it ourselves. So we formed the Kalu Church Restoration Project team. And from there, we went after the money. Now, the money came from various sources. It came from government, the Heritage Council. It came from the County Council. But most importantly, it came from our county councillors. And they were very, very generous. They have what is called a discretionary fund. That allied to the fact that we got a share of money from patrons, from our own resources, from some local companies, from the CMF fund, which gave us about 150,000. So we attacked the project, and there were four segments to it. One, the restoration. Next, we had to put together a website. Then down on top of that, we had to create a suitable sculpture and signage coming in here, which we're in the process of doing. That'll be the last portion of the project. And we had to create a pedestrian access way. All that will come to about 300,000.
How bad a state was the building in particularly, or the general area? Was it in poor state?
Disaster. And I suppose that's what encouraged us. When we saw the ivy spread all over it, weeds growing on top of the walls, saplings growing through the walls, it was a mess. In County Clare, there are about 130 or 40 such buildings. 30 of them are a disaster. They'll fall very, very soon if they haven't already fallen. Another 33%, mix them, gather them, might be rescued. Fortunately for ours was in the better third. So it was possible to preserve it, if you like. We weren't too sure if we could do it, but we were very fortunate. and this is key, we became in contact with Coleman and Company, who were recommended to us. And Coleman and Company had a very good man called Richard Robinson. He held us by the hand all through. And very, very quickly, he told us to go after a man called Jethro Sheen from Galway. He's an expert in this work. And we had it all done and dusted by the 24th of October, 2024. Was it in a bad state, you asked the question? It was almost collapse. And I would say that given the climate and given the bad weather, given the storms that we are now accustomed to, I'd say it would hit the ground within a few years. Now, as you look at it, we have it preserved for the next 100 years. It's a good bit of work and we're proud of it.
Did you ever think, though, Michael, no, we can't do this? Or was there a determination there, wherever that came from?
Oh, no, there was never any doubt. We have held 31 board meetings in the 5 years. Those board meetings would last for 3 hours. And we consulted with 185 people. Now, when you consult with those, most of them will give you a lead. And the secret for us was to follow every lead. And the more we probed, the more we realized it was doable. So one thing stood to us, all were focused, and each individual in our great group had a specific task. Engineer came into play, historian came into play, finance man came into play, and then finally we pulled it all together. It was never in doubt, but I tell you, I didn't think it would take 5 years.
Still ongoing, you mentioned the pathway earlier and you can see the Clare County Council application. You have a planning application in. What is the plan for the future for Killoo?
Very good question. The access here was through that field over there. It was an unprotected access, meaning that the cattle, cows, bulls and everything else were a danger to the public. So we decided we should put a protected walkway in here. We had grandiose plans initially to widen, the planning authority said. And only in the past 2 or 3 weeks, they said, reapply. We did apply. And thanks to the good work of a very good man down in Newmarket, a gentleman called Derek Burke. He owns a company called MAPS and APS. He is the man in charge of our planning. So we will get the planning, I would suggest, within the next 6 weeks. We have been in touch with the planning people, and they are sympathetic. Of course they would be sympathetic, but they will not violate the rules and regulations which you would accept and understand. We accept that we're going to have 6 weeks, so by the middle of May, we will have that planning in place. And immediately we will go after it. Under the guidance of Heber McMahon, we will have that completed by August. But that's not the finish of it, of course. We are in the process at this moment in time of getting some beautiful artwork, as I made reference to earlier. And that beautiful artwork is being created by a well-known artist here in County Clare, Michael McTighe. He has put together, I've seen the work, a beautiful sculpture of the gable end of that building. And of course, that building itself has 3 or 4 or 5 features from 1,000 years ago. One is the beautiful window. The other is the Stammer vault. The other is the omber that's inside there, kind of a place where the Eucharist was held for a while. And then, of course, we have this beautiful building here, if you would call it a mausoleum, built by the Lynchers in 1847. We will erect that piece of artwork over there. And around the place here, we're going to place some beautiful signage. Signage that would make you sit and ponder and think for a little while. Were quotes from the Bible, quote from that wonderful Clare man, John O'Donoghue. So we'll take one of his poems and we'll put it on a sign around here, so that when people come, they can reflect in peace in this beautiful place. And finally, I will have to say this. If we had any doubt after creating the thought in November of 2019, the doubt was removed when Bishop Fenton came here during COVID. And Bishop Fenton created a video. And it was a difficult time in this country. But he stood here near that ruin and he talked about the peace, the tranquility, the heavenly vista that one has here when one sits in quietness in this place. The peace and quiet, it was just magical. One of our people, Heber McMahon, said and gave a beautiful quote, "This place is magic and magical." But this place is about many things, and it's good that we have it preserved for posterity. But in the final analysis, we are talking about the people of 1,000 years ago. And my mind goes back to what they were like. What were the people like that built that place 1,000 years ago? Life must have been pretty grim for them. It's the past I remember most here.
Coming up, we'll hear more about the history of Killoo Church and the ongoing efforts to conserve the site and make it more accessible to the public. Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. The historic church at Killoo near Clare Castle is believed to be dedicated to St. Lugha and was part of a unique relationship between the Deanery of Traderee and nearby Clare Abbey up to the 16th century. Following an initial discussion between Gerard Lynch and Michael Slattery, the seed for plans to conserve the church and surrounding graveyard was sown and a committee of like-minded individuals was established. The members of the Killoo Church Restoration Project CLG have poured their hearts into conserving this historic site. Perhaps the church's most compelling and telling feature is the surrounding graveyard, which continues to be used as a place of burial and reflection. A burial vault for the well-to-do Starmer family of Carnelley was constructed within the church building in 1785. Several members of the family are interred here, including a duchess. The story of the Starmer family has been of particular interest to local man Frank Barry, another member of the Killoo Church Restoration Project CLG, who has been involved since the group's inception.
I'm living in the neighbourhood. I was born in the neighbourhood and I kind of love the area. I remember coming up here years ago when there was no motorway, there was no plaza, and you were just here in the middle of the country. You could be totally lost in yourself. It is an absolutely beautiful place, and it still is. We would have attended every funeral that came in here. Now, there was only maybe one or two a year coming in here. There's a Lynch vault over here, and there's many of the Lynch family buried here. There's a few Namarcus graves here, a few Dura graves here, a couple from locally in Clare Castle here. There hasn't been a burial here now, I think, in the last 18 months. Any burial that will be here will be of families that already have a plot here. It was totally rural. I mean, the people of Clare Castle wouldn't have known this place existed in reality. And if you can visualise it, it was totally overgrown. I mean, the west gable there was on the brink of falling. This east window, it was reasonably stable, with the rocks were starting to come off it as well.
You're on an elevated site, so
we're on an elevated site, yeah. And we're an elevated site, and this site, it is very hard to visualise it going back when it was built. I mean, if you can visualise, there was no banks in the River Fergus or in the Shannon. If we see all the outlying land here, it is all bogland, lowland, and it was subject to tidal flows. So at high tide, you literally had the water surrounding this place. We're in what's called the Barony of Islands, and this would have been one of the islands in the middle of it pre the construction of the banks. The history of it, it's regarded as one of the oldest standing old churches in the Diocese of Killaloe, and that Bishop Fenton has kind of stated that, and we've heard it from Dermot Gleeson's History of the Diocese. It is referred to as one of the oldest churches. I don't know if they were called churches, that because they weren't monasteries. They were small churches for, you imagine, a very small local population around.
It's always nice to learn something new. So you were interested in the history anyway yourself?
Oh, we're very, very interested in the history of it. And I'd say there's not a whole lot known about the history of these type churches. Like, and they're dotted around the Fergus estuary. But you can visualise the community they served at the time. Like, you know, they were probably the centre of learning, the centre of faith. There was probably land associated. There was probably a whole education system associated with them.
When we use our imaginations, we wonder what might have happened here.
Yeah.
And only archaeology, or if there were records available. But a lot of archaeology would tell you all of that.
There was surveys done, LIDAR survey done, and it showed two outer rings going around this. There is indications that there was a structure here, possibly the 7th century prior to this. It was a centre of probably pre-Christian activity as well as Christian activity.
It's all very curious and very interesting. In the chapel itself, or in the church itself, which isn't absolutely massive, but yeah, what stands out in here is this a tomb?
We call it is the Starmer tomb. It is the tomb of the Starmer family. Now, the Starmer family are a family that came to Ireland in the 1600s, in the early 1600s. They came from Essex in England. There was a George Starmer and his brother William. They came down to Clare and they married well, and that was a feature of their activities over the three or four centuries they survived here. They were a militaristic family. They married into kind of aristocracy. They married O'Briens, Burtons, the Bindons, the Westrops, they're the Matches. So they have a very, very interesting history. They were the sheriffs of Clare on numerous occasions over the centuries. They acquired 1,700 acres of land in the vicinity of Clare Castle. They acquired the Castle of Clare. And there's an interesting story about a George and William Stammer. They were involved in the sacking of Quin Abbey in somewhere around 1650 or 1660. The sacking and burning of Quin Abbey. They were with the Cromwellian forces. And the priest that was in Quin Abbey put a curse on the family. And he stated that over the course of three generations, that the male line of the family would die out. They would have no more offspring. And in reality, that turned out to be true. And there's another story related by Mary Westrop, that this George Stammer and his wife were in the battlements of Clare Castle up at the top, and she had a baby in her arm, and whatever happened, the baby escaped from her arm, fell over into the river and was carried away in the tide. And there's kind of a ghost story associated with the banks of the River Fergus, a bank that this lady is seen every now and again searching the banks for her child. They didn't have it all nice. Although much of the property was lost during the Jacobite Wars between 1689 and 1691, it was restored afterwards, and this George Stammer served as High Sheriff of Clare in 1681. As I said, married well. He married the daughter of the Mayor of Limerick, which strengthened his local ties. Now, he died in 1708, and he bequeathed his estate to his son William, who also became a High Sheriff of Clare, and he married Anna Bindon, who can relate Innes, Bindon Street, to the very influential Clare family. Actually, Anna Bindon's brother Francis Bindon designed the Carnelley House, the stately home of the Stammers. In the 18th century, the Stammers consolidated their position in County Clare through repeated appointments as High Sheriffs. William Stammer of Carnelley, who had it between 1750 and 1785, he held much land in the barony of Islands until his son William took over in 1783. There's a story of sad love and betrayal in relation to the Stammers. In 1768, there was a son of Lord Carbery. Lord Carbery was a very influential Irish and British politician at the time, and he owned thousands and thousands of acres in Cork and Limerick. But his son, who was called George Evans Freak, he visited Carnelley in 1768, and he fell madly in love with one of George Stammer's daughters. George was delighted and thrilled at this, because this really was going to bring him up in the world. But the daughter wasn't too impressed at all with this match, and she fought like hell against it. But being the nature of the day, she was forced to accept the match, and she said she'd go ahead with it. So the wedding was arranged for, I think it was November 1768, in Carnelley. And the tradition at the time was said the groom and all his friends, they went on the tear the day before the wedding, the day of the wedding, and the wedding would be scheduled for the late evening. So when they arrived for the nuptials, the bride, she sent her sister in instead. She was covered in a veil. The boys were half locked. But he didn't realise until the following morning that he'd been deceived. Now, this guy now was of a very influential family. He acknowledged the wedding, that it took place and that he had agreed to it, but he assaulted the bride and the lady he was supposed to marry, and he hit out of Carnelley, never to be seen again. And he actually died of alcoholism and debauchery in Paris in 1769. There was a lot of sadness associated with his family. And there was another son then who took over the lands in 1785. He was a Lieutenant George Stammer. And his story really adds finality to the Stammer line. He married Anna Westrop. He had a son born shortly after the marriage, I think 1815, but the son died. He died a couple of weeks after childbirth, and he's buried here, and he's acknowledged here on this headstone. There are two or three daughters after that. But the father was a very frail man, very sick. He had actually a premonition of his own death, and it was recorded by the great antiquarian Thomas Westrop. And this is quoted by Westrop, and the details of it are actually in the Clare Library. He says, "I have a vision. It was not a dream. I stood in our vault in Old Callooh Church, and as I looked down, I saw my father's coffin with its lid off, and my little son's coffin laid on top of it, another larger one. I went into it to read what was on the lid, and I read my own name with the date of April the 14th. And he just says to me, his wife, I forgot, Mary. I am sure I will die on one of those days." He mentioned 2 days, April the 14th or April the 24th. He died on April the 24th, 1819, and his funeral procession is described thus. "The long procession wound slowly down from straight Carnelley Avenue. The hearse reached Callooh as the last carriage left Carnelley. The vault was open, and there lay his father's coffin with a lid, as he had seen in the dream, or whatever you like to call it or think of it. They laid him opposite his father and placed his little son's coffin on his own, and the vision was fulfilled. Now, his story doesn't end there, though. He had a daughter, and his daughter is buried here. And his daughter was the Duchess of Rovigo. She was their daughter, Elizabeth. She was a highly educated lady. She was fluent in French. And after spending a few years in Paris studying, and apparently she was an accomplished writer of children's books, while there she met the son of a French aristocrat, General Anne Jean Maria René Savary. He was aide-de-camp to Napoleon, and he was head of an elite corps in Napoleon's army as well. He wasn't a nice guy from what I've read about him, to be honest. For his services, he was given the Duchess of Rovigo, which is a small state in Italy, about 50 miles southwest of Venice. This title passed to René Napoleon Savary, who married Elizabeth Stammer in 1819. The marriage took place in Clare Castle. He was a Catholic, she was a Protestant. That brought its own problems, because the aristocracy didn't like a Catholic potentially owning an estate in Ireland. But they got over that side of things anyway, and the marriage was blessed by Reverend Mr. Young, who was the rector, and Reverend Father O'Gorman, the local PP. This was followed by when they went to Paris, the French weren't happy with that. They had to go to a third wedding ceremony. So after the wedding, they leased out Carnelli and went to France, where he continued his service with the French army. Apparently he was a brave and gallant soldier up to his death in 1872. But it appears Elizabeth, she had enough of France, and she came back to Ireland in 1849. I think her hubby was a known kind of a dualist and womanizer, and he'd his own issues. But following her marriage, and there's another nice story as well, she inherited the Stammer Library. It was an impressive collection of artifacts, books and manuscripts that were got during the Napoleonic Wars in different countries. And they were based in the Stammer Library in Innes. As well as Carnelli, the Stammers had a house in Innes, Stammer House, back at Joe Daly's mortuary, and the Stammer Library was located there. But when the family line died out, everything was put up for auction. The last record we have, we say, of the Stammers in Killoo is the burial of the Duchess of Rovigo. She died in 1875, and the Clare Journal carried the following kind of obituary or death notice. The mortal remains of Elizabeth, Duchess of Rovigo, were consigned to their last resting place in the family vault of Killoo. Amid universal sorrow and regret, high, low, rich and poor, influence and poverty united in paying a tribute of respect to a lady who has passed forever from amongst us, but whose acts will long be remembered and held in grateful regard, as well as for their universality, as for their spirit of kindness and love which always guided them. The order of procession of the funeral is as follows. First came the hearse drawn by four horses. Then came the doctors and the clergy wearing scarves, the tenantry wearing scarves, the coffin and the remains, the chief mourners, mourning coaches, female servants on cars wearing hoods, several carriages, and lastly, the better peasantry. And Pat, out here in this southeastern part of the graveyard, just in front of the Lynch gravesite, we have what's called the Killoo Healing Stone, or a resting stone. There was an old tradition on funeral day of the coffin pallbearers shouldering the coffin and resting it on the flat stone, which is situated in front of the Lynch vault. It would be rested there for a few minutes and appropriate prayer said. The stone was regarded as having healing powers, and the belief was that the corpse left this world for a better life in heaven with all the pains and worries of life removed. It was also a lot of old graves, there was a tradition that you would never rest the coffin on the grass. So it was a resting stone as well to keep the coffin off the grass, as this was considered both disrespectful to the dead and a possible source of ill luck.
Coming up, we'll be back in Killoo near Clare Castle to hear more about the story of Killoo Church, which began long before the building we see today ever existed, maybe as far back as the 6th century. Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Killoo Church is located on an elevated site above the M18 motorway near Clare Castle and dates back around 1,000 years. It's believed the stone structure we see today was predated by a timber building. LiDAR imaging conducted on the site as part of a conservation project revealed a collection of concentric enclosures which are believed to be evidence of an earlier ecclesiastical site during the pre-Christian era, dating back to the 6th century. Liam Barry has a long-standing family connection with Killoo Church and looks after finance for the volunteer group. He is responsible for sourcing funds to help the Killoo Church Restoration Project Committee continue their invaluable work.
To do anything nowadays costs, I suppose it always costs money. But before you go tackling a project, you have to have a structure. And the structure that we have was that we formed the Killoo Church Restoration Project, CLG. That led us down the pathway where we were now in the position where we could look for grant funding. And with a monument like this, this is classified as a monument. That meant we could approach the community monument funding, and they have several streams of funding. So the first was stream one, and we applied for €30,000. And that was so we could complete a feasibility study. And of course, the purpose of the feasibility study was to get the experts in to see what we could do, what could be done with the building here, what could be done with the boundary walls and the area in general. So we got the experts in, and the community monuments funded that expertise to the tune of €30,000. We got architects, we got conservation architects, archaeologists, ecologists, land surveyors, historical, genealogical consultants. So that's quite an amount of expertise, and expertise costs money. And unfortunately, grant funding rarely, if ever, covers the full cost of any part of a project. The fact that you're dealing with a national monument that's listed, you have to go about things the right way. You can't just walk in and start doing restorations or conservations. You have to do it the right way. And when you do it the right way, you get the right expertise and you pay for that expertise. Based on that feasibility study, we were now in a position to get a conservation plan. And John Deaton, conservation architect, he put a plan together based on the reports from all the other experts. So we were now in a position where we could go for stream two funding from the Community Monuments Fund. And we applied for €100,000, and we were successful in that application. So based on that money, we were able, in a position to conserve the church, secure the boundary walls, and maybe do a little bit of planning for the future. I live very, very local here. This region was my playground as a young fellow. So I remember the gables were top heavy with ivy, and I would safely say that if some conservation work had not been done prior to Storm Éowyn, which is fairly recent, I have no doubt in my mind but those gables would probably have toppled over. The Stamer Monument there, part of it had fallen down. That was restored. The walls were littered with ivy, boundary walls and the old church ruin walls. So based on the funding we received from Community Monuments, we got a conservation expert who deals with national monuments. They're Sheen stone construction. They're based above in Gort. And he did a fantastic job for us. We're quite proud of what he did.
Did you ever think that this is too big a job? Because the way you've described the ivy on the building, it sounds like it was a mammoth task.
You see, when you look at a church that was probably built in the 1200s, you say, sure, look, it's a ruin. But I mean, it's now a conserved ruin there, and you can put a shape to it, you can use your imagination and see what was there. And without any work, it would have fallen asunder. So, you know, it was, from my mind, money well spent. But I'd say as a group, we're all volunteers. You know, we all came from a past life, different jobs, etc. And we got together for this. And we all had different ideas of what conserve means. To preserve, to conserve, to restore. We had notions of maybe restoring this, which was totally off the wall in hindsight. Which was that's what drove us. See, could we make it better? Could we conserve it for future generations? And as part of our project, we wrote to people who are associated with the area, who would have loved ones buried here, who would have connections, maybe from many generations, and we asked them, would they like to be involved in the project and maybe help us out somewhere or other? And we got a very nice reply from people who assisted us financially with the project. And we referred to that group of people as the Friends of Killoo. So we raised substantial money through the Friends of Killoo project. And our local credit union gave us a grant as well. If you have a worthwhile project, you will find people who will support you.
Do you feel as well, Liam, I wonder, that you owe it to the people who built this, because it's still standing over 1,000 years later, The walls are thick and solid. They put work into it. Do you believe you owe it to them?
Without a shadow of a doubt. I'm living in a house now down there in Knocknamana, as the crow flies maybe a kilometre from here. And the site that my house is built on, there was an old thatched house there, and that man is buried up there. It's a non-mat grave, but I have an idea where he is. I have ancestors here, the McMasters. We owe it to them. I have two children buried over there myself, who died in 2008 and 2011. And from my point of view, I owe it to them. So for me, it's a project well worth undertaking. And with the group, we have a wonderful group of people who are as keenly interested in it as I am.
Apart from your own very personal connection with Killoo Church, you have an ancestral connection going back some time as well.
I have, Pat. There's a headstone there now right behind you. It's the Hassett headstone, and my family have a close association with that. And it's through a chap called Michael Masters. He was born in Cool Dalian in the parish of Kilmichael in County Cork in 1844. He was one of three siblings. His brothers were William, John. Now, John Masters is my great-grandfather, and Michael is my great-granduncle. Michael trained as a school teacher and was appointed principal over in Dura School. While there, he met a young lady from Clarecastle called Ellen Hassett. She was the daughter of Patrick Hassett and Honora or Hannah O'Brien of Clarecastle. Or back then it was known as Clare Village. It was the village of Clare. And I think it's very sad that we actually changed that name. However, that's the way things go. Now, Michael and Ellen were married in July 1874. They had nine children. Some of the children, the records are on the baptismal cert in Clarecastle. Some were baptised Masters, others were McMasters. Because a name change took place from Masters to McMasters in the late 1800s for some reason. So Ellen died at the age of 40. Now, she had nine children, but she died at the age of 40 in 1893, not long after giving birth to a baby, Francis Benedict, who actually survived. Ellen is buried there in the Hassett grave with her parents, Patrick and Hannah or Honora. Michael Masters or McMasters, being a grocer and a farmer and the headmaster in Dura School, there would be a reasonable expectation that life would be good. Farming and teaching were good professions at the time, and starting their married life in July 1874, I suppose prospects were good. However, life writes its own story. Times were harsh for everyone, and living conditions were not conducive to good health. Despite, I assume, having a slightly better standard of living, maybe not, maybe so, disease and sickness are never selective. Tragedy ravaged many households. The McMasters or Masters were no exception. And then again, maybe they were the exception. As I said at the outset, nine children were born to Michael and Ellen. Five of those were to die within 5 years of each other, between 1891 and 1896, with Ellen herself dying within the same time frame. 1891 in particular was a horrendous year for Michael and Ellen. In the month of August, three of their children died within 9 days of each other. On the 20th of August, Veronica Masters died at the age of four. She died in the workhouse in Innes of croup. 5 days later, Francis, age six, died of diphtheria. And 3 days later, Elizabeth, age seven, died in the same workhouse of croup. Now, I cannot even imagine the impact this had on the McMaster family. Losing three of your children in the space of just over a week is beyond comprehension. The sadness was further compounded when Ellen herself died in 1893, just 4 weeks after giving birth to Francis Benedict. So in the space of 2 years, Michael had lost three young children and was now widowed. Unfortunately, more tragic was to follow. His 18-year-old son, John, was drowned in a boating accident on Garland Sunday in 1894, about 1 mile down the quay from Clarecastle up Isle of McGrath. It was reported in the Clare Journal that three young men, John McMasters, eldest son of Michael McMaster, Clarecastle, and schoolmaster in Dura, John McGowan, a clerk in the employment of Pat O'Brien Carnelly, and Pat O'Kelly, the only son of Patrick O'Kelly, a respected coal merchant, set out from the quay in Clarecastle. Only John McGowan survived to raise the alarm. For a small fishing village of Clare, this was a huge tragedy. For Michael McMaster, his grief must have been beyond understanding. And then 2 years later, in 1896, Michael's 18-year-old son Thomas died of Bright's disease of the kidney. And on the 5th of November, 1910, Michael himself died, his death certificate recorded chronic alcoholism. Now, it is my belief that all those are buried there in the Hassett grave. I guess with so much loss over a short period of time, the updating of the headstone was a very, very low priority. Michael's and Ellen's only surviving daughter, Mary Josephine, married my grandfather, Garrett Barry, who was from McGowna. She died at the age of 40, giving birth to a baby called Mary Josephine on the 4th of August, 1920. She and her daughter are buried there in that Hassett grave. So I often pass by here and I look at that headstone and I often wonder, how can any headstone carry such a weight? But life always goes on, Pat. And despite tragedy, Garrett Barry married the daughter of John Masters, who was a first cousin of his first wife, and she had come up to help mind the children that were left behind. And that second marriage yielded two children, Sean and Liam. And Liam is my father. So there's a lot of sadness associated there with the Hassett grave, and it's one I contemplate on regularly.
The volunteers of the Killoo Church Restoration Project have produced an excellent and informative website with a photo gallery, information for visitors, and regular updates on the progress of their ongoing work. The website also features a series of professionally made videos telling different aspects of the story of Killoo Church and life in medieval Ireland and its more recent history. One of these videos features Liam Ash, a retired history and geography teacher and a Killoo Church Restoration Project volunteer. In Sheen Liam, Scale Shepale Killoo Askelaga.
Tommy Dirichon Show and Ishbalahe in Akilation Shepale Show. Leshun chach fobel a togug mile blino hindu marshin agus chach fobel antavert de gevia unders nadine ach tame erti kaintenish eron bobel eron jang gwelach a vi in usaide ko chang den vanish vi aun ni hikimish nishe maris shana reel ger fader taigest ni rev mitchen hat egonom scho litterer er chorbe En ni rif sydd yn o'n leif dy gna, o'n chwyd ysmol co. Agos mae'r sy'n gweilge sy'n plir ffad y fi yn wsaid y co. Fi o'n ffoglwr cwng glwr ni'r efach bedr mil yn nwgo fil y ffoglawn. Agos fi o'n gweilge cyn yn wsaid y co lo i ni y gle. Fi sydd y caint mae'r iawler na hafyr sio mae'r hawnplet na ba. Agus fecin gwyl ba diolch yn echel un yn eisiau ar yn bar tef hir ddyn o'n sy'n agos ar yna cwyrig agos ar yna gawyr agos fi cerca y co agos mar sy'n de agos cad i fi cwrdd ddach o'r he o'n clawn ar nwy na pas di agos comal e sy'n cwrsi bîg cwrsi dîden se sy'n na tehe a fi y co na bohaen a fi y co na ba a fi y co agos ar nwy fi dlasri agos ffermorach ter siwl y co chyma agus fi becha y co, agus fi si dabelte o'n fil y faliw, agus mil e wsaid mor fie. A chymal e sy'n fi si dabelte joch alcohol y ienaf as o'n fil ar noe chyma. Agus da me ffai caint lo yn ish naw, la daref gwref si tain. Fe dis i goni yr awel naw, cahamid. Cwr lais tradisiwn te a ywsaid agos fi lifen a cof falid eich na lifen a'r ffwrdd na hoite o'n sio agos fi sais shaman a cof yn ymesg fer lais no beder ben lais agos falig siid na lifen a agos fan siid ywsaid os yn bocin chwn chyle horte lais a hawrt o chyna agos is minic ar noi a hwg siid bywganin omrca ffocin agos marsin de agos fi o'n bos an y chongrwch doif fi o'n bos an y chongrwch doif ffwr y lôn deg y lôn pas di gylwa caelag na ceit y dîna solar eif siid sian ar chorr be ni lein cosulat ar chorr be gorefwn black dit o'n galor dof o'n sio mae'r oed fwy'n dŵa y behe fi se limenach agos fi se i gorcwig agos i malio hatlia ac ni ref se o'n sio ni refein dail oel y co le Saxonig a fi awn nhw leis na Normanig mae'r fi na Normanig wel fi sied yn sôn i machra orga yn y her yn Golden Vale yn sy'n agos mar sy'n de ach sefian is biog dyn y Norman ych y fi yn sio mar sy'n cadw fi e cwrs dach o'r he yfyr hen o'n credaf hen o'n credaf gymwyr lo mar fi sy'n misterach rŵn difyr a fi awn agos cenach ref tisgyn dro fahaco er o'n effren falig siid gwleir le chael o'n sio agos chwl siid o'n legend agos wel naw chaf siid gwref siid i lor na crinna mar fi o'n legend gyhaling agos fi o'n un sagrat e gober un sin go croifach i glef un efrin agus fi gachina agus a meal eroskilt agus iad eich band lan a sŵl as un sagrat mar hain un misteir un rŵn diver agus mar sin de agus dosgil se un seil doiv ug se pictur doiv chursi ele chursi fiaul sŵnachta. Now, ni féidir rágur philosophers nó fiáil súnathe iad. Ach mar sin héin, bhí an tafran agus an credibh antábhacht dóibh.
As we take our leave of this historic and peaceful site, we should never forget that Killoo Church has been saved from certain ruin by a group of dedicated volunteers. Looking forward, it's hoped more people will visit the site to learn the story of Killoo Church and those who have passed through here over the past 1,000 years and even longer. The work of the Killoo Church Restoration Project continues with plans for a public pathway to allow easier access to the site. A number of sculptures and information signage will also be erected. Michael Slattery.
And one of the signs that we're going to put around this place will be a quotation from that wonderful man, John O'Donoghue. And in that quote, he writes about the passing a graveyard. May perpetual light shine upon the faces of all who rest here. May the lives they lived unfold further in spirit. May all their past travails find ease in the darkness of clay. May the remembering earth mind every memory they brought. May the rains from heaven fall gently upon them. May the wild flowers and grasses whisper their wishes into light. And may we reverence the village of presence in the stillness of this silent field.